Hi, everyone. I am Sarah Edmondson, and I'm here with...
Hi, I'm Anthony Ames, Sarah's husband, a.k.a. Nippy.
And we're here to talk about things that are a little bit culty. Speaking of, we were in a cult and we woke up, thank goodness, and we have a lot to say.
And a lot to ask.
This podcast is going to be a deep dive into everything from the red flags to the narcissism, the manipulation, the resiliency, the recovery process, and everything in between. Also, we want to share some of the good we got out of it so you can get all the nuggets without having to join a cult.
If you haven't already, because there are a lot of things out there that are just a little bit culty.
Welcome to A Little Bit Culty, a podcast about the fads, beliefs, and trends that blur the line between healthy and a little bit culty. Please subscribe so you don't miss an episode and find us on Instagram if you have any suggestions for things you have found to be a little bit culty. Under the surface, the water fills my lungs. This ground I worship has swallowed up its young. And you give for a promise. Hey, everybody. Welcome back to A Little Bit Culty. I'm Sarah, and I'm here with my handsome husband.
What up, kids?
What's going on, babe?
What's going on? I posted this meme. There's a meme that's going around that has kind of this aristocratic guy sitting in a chair with his two kids.
Like from the 50s, like one of those old-fashioned 50s meme.
Kind of like an old, those were the days kind of thing. And it has the kid asking the dad a question. And I told Sarah I wanted to do a little thing about it. And she went and had it made. And it says, what did you do during the coronavirus, daddy? And it says, I put a sociopath narcissist in jail for 120 years. And the kid on the floor says, fucking legend. So I'm just laughing at all the comments that I got on that.
I think that meme goes well also with your new shoes that you're wearing, your gold Nikes.
I'm getting some play on those too. I got some gold. They're called Vandals. You would have first seen them in the Terminator when John Connor comes back from the future and he puts them on. I do a nice close up on them. But they were before Air Jordan or anything like that. I went major old school for those and I got them in gold. Can't argue with those.
Nippy also got me gold Nike Air. What are they called?
They're Air Force One.
Air Force One.
They're Lowe's. Oh my God. Can we just start this whole thing over?
No,
embarrassed. You know, I get you gold shoes. This is the treatment I get. My God.
They're probably the best present you've ever gotten me. And the best part about it was that he told me that he thought that there was something, a light on in the closet. There was something glowing. And I was like, what? He's like, can you just go check? I think there's like a weird light on. And I went and looked and there's these beautiful glowing gold shoes.
That's how you do it, kids.
It is how you do it. You know, this relates to what people have been asking, like, how are you doing with your healing? And what's life like after the cult? And
Nike.com. That's how you do it.
That's how you do it. It's called retail therapy.
Yep.
But in all seriousness, I think that...
That was serious.
Yeah. I know it was serious, but somebody wrote the question for the day was like, what's the thing that you enjoy the most about your freedom? And I think I didn't let myself do things that would have been deemed as like indulgent or satiative is what was the word that Nexium used, like buying things like that because they weren't needs. And that's something that you and I've really been unpacking, don't you think?
Like, well, I've actually been buying shoes like that for quite a bit.
Well, it's because you weren't as obedient as I was in the cult.
Defiant, they would say.
Yeah. You know, we've talked about how our issues were used against us. And because Nippy wasn't as much of a sheep as I was, they said that he was defiant, that he had anger issues. And
which is true. I mean, I get pissed every now and then, but I wouldn't say they're anger issues. I mean, it's human to get pissed. That's how they control you, which is in our upcoming guest book. It's a great segue to that.
Yes. Our guest today is going to be talking exactly about that. And we're really excited to have her. But that's my other question for you, Nip. Like, what other freedoms do you enjoy since leaving?
Well, now that we're in this lockdown COVID thing, I kind of feel constricted again. But, you know, I just don't like having to be on a certain schedule and be in certain cities and traveling with a kid. I like actually having the consistency of the day-to-day and a routine.
Yeah, we did a lot of traveling.
Well, routine is where, like, you know, you get your success, right? You have to have a routine to be successful. And our routines were always getting broken up. Any sort of momentum we had in other areas outside of the organization were always thwarted because we had to be somewhere for 2-3 weeks. And then, you know, it was just a shit show.
I remember when we first left and I cleared all of my recurring events in my calendar, all of the different, like, the proctor call, the green call, the commerce call, the executive board call, the coaching call, the goals up call. There was like somewhere between 30 to 40 hours of recurring calls.
I always told you to get rid of that shit.
I know I had to do it.
There was this thing called a proctor call, right? And I got on like one of them. And Sarah was always trying to obligate me to get on them. I'm like, I'm not sitting on that fucking thing for an hour and listening to people just talk about shit, talk about meetings the whole time.
Like we never got anything done.
No, but it was like, I just refused to do it. And everyone tried to be like, well, you know, they tried all the shit. They tried all the like, well, what does this mean? I'm like, it means I don't fucking give a shit about being on that call. It's boring to me. Nothing gets done. I'm going to go do something while you guys talk about it.
You know, eventually I learned that I could, you know, go on walks or clean up my apartment or things like that and multitask, something that I also got in trouble for later in the cult. But anyway, when I was able to like clear my calendar of all those recurring events, all of a sudden I had this empty space. And one of the things that was part of my healing was trying to figure out how do I want to spend my time now that I have my life back, which is a perfect segue for introducing our next guest, Yanya Lalich, who wrote my favorite cult recovery book called Take Back Your Life. She's an incredible resource and is hugely inspirational to us every step of our way in our healing journey. I'd say she's iconic.
Yeah, her book is, for me, was the definitive narrative as to what happened, how it happens, and everything. She's someone who has been through a heavy-duty cult indoctrination, woken up, gotten her way out. She's kept on going. She's dedicated her life to helping other people understand how cults operate and how to come back from them.
She's a PhD, a researcher, author, and educator specializing in self-sealing or closed systems, which means she's an expert in things like cults, human trafficking, coercive influence, and all kinds of ideological extremism.
She's who the international intelligence community calls on when they need insights on how cults and extremist groups recruit, indoctrinate, influence, and control you.
She's someone I've called on to help unpack so many things about my experience in NXIVM. I actually met her on the set of A&E's Cults and Extreme Beliefs, the first big interview that I did. This was before The Vow. And recently, I had the honor of being the narrator for the audiobook version of her book, Take Back Your Life, Recovering from Cults and Abusive Relationships, which is just one of the many books that Yanya's written. But this book in particular explains the seductive draw that leads people into these situations and provides guidelines for assessing what happened and hands-on tools for getting back on track. It's written specifically for victims, their families, and professionals like therapists as a guide through the healing process.
We'll share that info in our show notes after this. But for now, here's our conversation with the mighty and wonderful Yanya Lalich. Sinking down to the depths of the ocean.
Yanya, thank you so much for joining us.
Oh, I'm happy to be here. I'm excited you have started this podcast.
So are we. It was sort of a reluctant choice, but now that we're on the train, it seems like the right thing to do for us.
Yeah. I mean, we had some great people approach us and basically said, can we bring this stuff into your living room and watch you have conversations? I mean...
So what we're doing anyway.
We're doing that anyway. So right. We figured out, you know, if they were interesting enough, we'll find out, I guess.
Yeah. We don't know if other people are going to find this as interesting as we do.
Well,
but
we can bring more interesting people than us, which isn't hard to find.
Yes. Like you, Yanya. When I met you in New York, I was like, I mean, first of all, I'd already read your book, right?
Right, right.
And
you had it with you.
And I had it with me, and I got you to sign it. And right. You were the guest expert on cults and extreme beliefs for A&E.
Right.
And I was so excited to meet you, and you know, our conversations behind the scenes were great. In front of the camera were so helpful. I remember going for dinner with you afterwards, and we were like, you know, let's start our own thing. I don't know what it's going to be, but it will be something, you know. And then we were like, wait, we can't form another group. That would not be good. But just to have an ally in you as I'm not technically an educator in the way that you are as an actual professor. Yeah, now you're a professor emerita. What does that mean?
What that means is when you retire from a professorship, your department meets after you're gone. They don't do this in front of you, but they meet and they decide whether to give you emerita status or emeritus for the men. And it basically means like honorable, right? So I'm retired honorable professor.
That's amazing. And you actually have this whole, you know, not only your educational background, but you have your personal experience background, which makes you, I think, a true expert. And I'm sure you're so sick of telling the story over and over again. And I know it, but I want our listeners to know if you could kind of encapsulate this short version of your cult experience, you know, how you got in, and I've got a couple questions for you, but overall, what we want to talk about is your experience, how you got in, how you got out, what the red flags were. And then we have questions for you about what's happening now politically, but also like in regards to the Nexium world and some of the things that you see. And then Nippy's got some specific questions about healing and spotting certain things so that our listeners can like really understand the template. Does that sound good?
Sounds good. Yeah.
And
how
whatever
much time do we have?
I say it's going to take about 6 hours.
Yeah. We have to order in food.
I love the 15 characteristics of a sociopath. I think if people could really understand those and identify those, it would weed out a lot of those characteristics in our leaders. And I especially like the part in your book about loaded language.
Uh-huh.
You see a lot of that going on politically as well. And I find if you control the language, you can put handcuffs on any real conversations.
Yeah, absolutely.
You can control the thoughts and minds of people if they're going around, you know, whether, you know, regardless of where you are in the political spectrum, you know, there's a great quotation. George Carlin has, political correctness is fascism with manners. And I just see a lot of the parallels when I was reading about the loaded language part of your book. I just remember thinking, good God, this is really, you know, you control words, you control thoughts, you control behaviors, and you really have soldiers.
Yeah, absolutely.
That was really just enlightening for me to see that broken down.
Many of our listeners and who've been following us on Instagram as well saw the Instagram live I did with Yanya. So I'm going to spare you at the pain of having to relive some of that, because you got really personal with me about your life and your mom. But if you can give us just the sort of the overview of the cult that you were in, and what drew you in, what did you think you were getting involved with?
So I had been living in Europe, and I moved back to San Francisco, or to San Francisco, in 74. And so I was new in town and sort of discovering feminism. I was coming out as a lesbian. I was, you know, slowly meeting new people. And this was right at the end of the Vietnam War. So people on the left were kind of looking for what to get involved in next. And a lot of the major cities in the country had what were called study groups, where small groups of people, friends, whatever, would get together and read various literature and talk and, you know, strategize and whatever. So I met a friend of a friend who invited me. We'd have coffee, you know, talks over coffee. And one day she invited me to join their study group. And I thought, well, that was cool. You know, I'll meet some new people. And the topic was going to be women and the state. Like, what is the role of women in activism? And so I went to the study group. I mean, there were a lot of whistles already. Like, I was told not to tell anybody. And I was like, well, why can't I tell anybody about the study group? And they're like, well, we don't, you know, we just want to invite certain people. Anyway, I didn't realize there was an organization behind the study group, that it was actually a front for recruiting. So within probably a month or so, she met with me again at my house and told me they had this organization, this political organization, and, you know, would I be interested in joining? So I joined. I mean, it's a lot happens in between there, but anyway, I joined. I really had no clue what I was joining. They told me it was a large international organization, which it wasn't. It had maybe 40 members at that time, or maybe 25.
Wow.
And so we were politically left. It was a Marxist organization. We were going to, you know, get rid of racism and sexism and classism and eventually have the revolution. Mm-hmm. And I was completely into it. I mean, I was 30 years old then, and I felt like it was time to, you know, do something with my life. And these seemed like really serious people. So the red flags of all the rules and regulations and things I had to change about myself, you know, I kind of rationalized, because I thought, well, this is what I need to do to be part of this really serious organization. So the group was very strict. I was very quickly moved up into leadership. I was one of the educators within the group teaching political study. I was in the inner circle. And it was, you know, we spent most of our time sitting around criticizing each other, because we were supposed to get rid of our bourgeois tendencies, right? and that got very harsh, and it got very mean. And so And other than that, we had work assignments and people worked, you know, we all worked like 18-hour days, 7 days a week, month after month, year after year.
I have a question.
Yeah.
What was the thing that you were criticized for? What was your issue?
Oh, I was criticized for a lot of things.
Did you have a theme?
Well, one of the themes was that I was trying to compete with the leader.
Oh.
And that was obviously a real no-no. I had this sort of love-hate relationship with the leader, who was a woman and actually had been a sociologist. And she was a drunk and a megalomaniac and very domineering. And she loved me and held me up a lot as a symbol because I was from the working class and most people in the group weren't. So I was like this working class hero to her. But on the other side, she would slap me down all the time. So it was... You know, it was one of these situations where when the cult leader is about to arrive, you never know if it's going to be the nice, sweet cult leader or the monster, right? And so you're always kind of on your walking on eggshells. So anyway, I was in the group for 10 years. I had two big moments of disillusionment. And the final one had to do with the death of my mother, which I'm not going to go into all that right now. Mm-hmm. But
people can refer to my Instagram live if they want that story, because it's right. it's pretty amazing and beautiful and sad. And
yeah. So after that, I was miserable and I hated being in the group and I wanted to leave, but I couldn't figure out how to leave. I had no money. I had a broken down car. I had no one outside the group. I didn't know where to go. We were told we'd die in the streets if we left. So for 5 years, I was miserable and I would literally pray. Well, I didn't pray, but I would wish every day that I would be killed in a car accident because it was the only way that I could see to get out. Ironically, we finally had our revolution. And at one point when the leader was out of the country, we called everyone together, told them what was really going on. It took almost a week to convince everybody that we were telling the truth. And we then took a vote and voted unanimously to expel the leader and dissolve the organization. So we all got out at the same time.
Wow. And how did the leader react to this revolution?
Oh, God. So when she came back, what we had done was we assigned a team of people to meet with her. And we went to the house where she was living. One of the members had rented a house for her in San Francisco, and she had another house in Bodega Bay. But anyway, she her bodyguard picked her up at the airport and brought her back, and she sat in the living room, and there were, I think, six or seven people there trying to tell her the party's over, so to speak. And she didn't get it. She was like not understanding. And then finally, at one point, she pulled out a cigarette. And we always did everything for her, right? We blew her nose. So she's holding the cigarette and she's waiting for someone to get up and light her cigarette. And nobody gets up. And that's when she got it. That's when she realized they were telling her, wow, we're done. So then she screamed and hollered and threw a fit. And yeah, and so they told her she had a month to get out of the house. And that was it. She tried to sue us for wrongful termination, which was pretty funny. And then, you know, then we all helped each other sort of get our lives back.
Wow. And how long after that did you write Take Back Your Life?
Let's see. I got out in 86, and the first version of Take Back Your Life, which was called Captive Hearts, Captive Minds, that came out in, I believe, 94.
You had some time to heal yourself and learn about that process.
Oh, yeah. I did a lot of reading and writing and therapy.
Yeah. What would you say was your primary wound care in terms of your healing process?
For me, it was because I had been in leadership and I had really done a lot of really shitty things. I modeled myself after the leader. Mm-hmm. And so I was mean and vindictive and bitchy, and people hated me justifiably. And so when I got out, I had so much shame and guilt about the things I had done, the people I had expelled and criticized, and all that. And so that was really hard for me. And I made a point of trying to go back to everyone who I had personally done something to and apologize, which hopefully helped both of us. But you know, there are still people who won't talk to me. And there are people who actually really dislike me because I've written about the group and talk about the group publicly because they think we shouldn't do that.
Oh, well, I'm glad that you do.
Yeah, well, it's also, we've experienced a little bit of that, not so much directly. There's always going to be people that have a problem with your process. Exactly. One of the things that Sarah and I, when we were discussing doing a podcast, is we know firsthand that there's a lot of people that just walked away from Nexium. And it's our hope, particularly the people in Mexico, is to do something that they can maybe listen to and understand the importance of going and just checking to see, kicking the tires. And I think, you know, reading the first 30 pages of your book, you can get, at least for me, I remember reading the first 30 pages and going, boom, that was mine, moral injury. I identified right away, and it gave me really good context to diagnose myself and then figure out what next, to understand what and how and really what was self-inflicted and all that stuff. So that's really where I think you come from. Obviously, you wrote a book, and where I think today, where people get a lot of their content in a podcast, hopefully they can listen to this. They don't even have to credit us, but then go find the resources to do some work. And what would you say to those people who think they can just walk away from something, regardless of how peripheral they were?
Yeah, I think it's like any abusive relationship or traumatic experience. You can't just walk away from it. It'll stick with you. And so you have to process it. It's mm-hmm. the only way to really be able to move on and not have all kinds of lingering emotional upheavals and nightmares and emotions that you can't figure out, whatever. And so I think doing this, what we call psychoeducation, when you get out of a cult or a high control group or that kind of relationship, is so important, because you need to understand what were the forces that were working on you that got you to be who you were in that group and got you to do the things you did. Because unless you do that, you don't understand the power of those techniques and the power of that entire system on you. And so people tend to be ashamed or embarrassed, or they don't want to talk about it and they don't want to look at it, but you have to look at it and you have right. to kind of take it apart. And just speaking about Mexico, you know, Take Back Your Life was actually published in Mexico in Spanish by a Mexican publisher.
Wow. What's it? Do you know what it's called?
It's called Something Sectas.
Yeah.
I have a copy, and I don't know if it's still available, but, you know, that was actually the first edition that was published in Spanish. So that was mm-hmm. in the mid-90s. And I don't know if it's still available, but
we'll look into that. Put it in our show notes that people can find on the internet and on Apple and stuff.
But yeah, I'll send you the title and the publisher.
Please do.
Yeah.
What you said is interesting for me, because we were just talking about, like, especially a lot of people in Nexium were like, oh, it's a cult. Okay. And then they left and went back to their lives and didn't process. And I think also because of, and this is probably not unique to Nexium, but especially in Nexium, because of the whole at cause concept, which was foundational. And I'm sure you've heard about this now, that, you know, we cause everything in our life and we make choices and we're not victims. That even people that I, you know, helped get out or left, and they were like, yeah, Keith is bad and all that stuff. Like when I was trying to help them write their victim statement, just even the concept of writing a victim statement for a lot of people, they were like, but I chose this. And I'm like, no, but you didn't. You didn't choose this. You would have never chosen this. And so doing a lot of the work that I think needs to be done, people can't even take that first step because they're still not willing to unprogram themselves or even look at the fact that they were duped. Because right. that doesn't right. fit in with the narrative.
Well, it's pride.
Exactly. Right. Yeah. It's hard to admit you've been duped.
It's pride. Mm-hmm. You have yeah. to take a bite out of the humble pie and start that journey. And the longer you prolong that, the more indoctrinated you are and the more you have to double down. And the stuff that people who are still indoctrinated into are doubling down on now is absurd.
Yeah.
And so for me, it becomes, you're watching a train wreck. At first, I'm kind of reactive to it. And in particular, right now, there's something going on where they're outing my wife and they're saying negative things about my wife.
That my narrative was false.
But the absurdity of their claim kind of speaks for itself. So I don't really have a reaction so much to anything except I feel badly for them.
Uh-huh.
It's not like, I mean, everything is just made up now. And you're watching that people keep changing the narrative. They blur context, they lie by omission, and you're seeing good people, and regardless of what they're saying and doing to us, I know in there's good people, and they're in prison.
Right. Well, they're really showing how desperate they are.
Right.
You know, I might surmise that part of that desperation may be because now they no longer have contact with Keith,
right.
Because that was one of the conditions of the sentence. And And that actually gave me some hope, because I thought maybe by not having contact with him, at least some of them might eventually, you know, drift away and come to see what they've really been part of. But it is sad. It is sad.
It is. And the world waiting for them. You know, all they have to do is pivot.
Exactly. You know? Yeah.
What was that like for you to read? Did you read the whole thing, their manifesto?
I skimmed it. Yeah. Mm-hmm. I mean, it was, you know, they certainly went at you, which mm-hmm. is absurd. And hopefully you're not taking it personally, so to speak.
No,
you know, it's hard to, you know, the same kind of things happened to me because I wrote about my cult, because there were a lot of people who wanted to carry on with leftist work and they didn't want it known that they had been in a cult, even though everybody knew. I mean, they wrote about us in every leftist newspaper. So I understand what that's like. I mean, I remember going to my first book reading with Margaret Singer when I wrote the book with her, and several of them were in the audience, like heckling, you know. So wow. I know it's difficult, but they aren't going to make any traction with that. Nobody's going to believe that. I mean, who are they even appealing to? Are they drawing anyone in? There's no evidence of that.
I don't think so. I mean, I Nippy and I were talking about, like, okay, let's just say that my narrative was entirely false and that I made the whole thing up and I'm a liar or whatever. Even if you pull that me out of the equation, there's still this whole body of evidence and all these other people who've spoken up about, even, by the way, way worse things. Worse than what happened to me.
Right.
So I don't know why they think that, like, discrediting me is going to help their case.
I think because you're popular.
Yes, exactly.
Yeah, hate me. I get
it. I think they think Sarah has gotten something externally that they want. And by the way, you can have it.
Yeah, this is like, this is not.
Do you know what I mean? Like, you're welcome to it. But I read a quotation recently. It's like, if you go down the road for revenge, be sure to dig a grave for two. And I think that they're going down a road for revenge, masquerading as altruistic, and it's not going to end well. Right. It just won't end well. And that's the thing. Ultimately, if you're a human being, you're sensitive to when you watch this, even though you're at the other end of the slings and arrows. So one of the things that we've debated internally is address it, don't. And I just don't feel like giving it a platform because...
Yeah, well, I mean, I would agree with that. Why put your energy there?
Yeah.
It's basically cult behavior. I mean, it's the same thing that Keith did, right? He mm-hmm. he couched all his perversion and sadism and, you know, his disgusting behavior was couched in ethics and, you know, good works, you know. So they're basically doing the same thing, you know, pretending that they're the altruistic ones and they're the ones who really know what happened. And, you know, there, as you said, Sarah, there's been, I mean, all you have to do is look at the trial and the charges that came out in the trial, and mm-hmm. you didn't even testify in the trial, did you?
No, they didn't need me.
Exactly. So
no, she didn't even go. I went. That's where I met you. That's
exactly.
I saw you. I was there just kind of representing, and
she was home with the baby.
Thank God, you know, she didn't go.
Thank God. And also, that was another thing I got from your book. Speaking of the baby, is that I read somewhere. But you mentioned that, like, when you give birth, where you have a child, you get it's very healing because you're giving birth to your own inner child, metaphorically. And I think having a second baby after we left, I mean, it really forced me to step out of the trauma because I wanted to create a safe place to, you know, house my child for 9 months inside me. And I didn't want to be stressed.
Right.
And I stopped reading the Frank report, and I stopped engaging in my fight for a little bit, which was, I think, really good for me and really healing, and you know, and helped also overcome a lot of the PTSD because I just needed, I just slept. I just had the proper rest I needed, which I think is another healing nugget I would share, that when people leave these things, is that, especially if you've been in a cult where you're a worker bee, like you and I both were, and you never have any downtime, learning to have downtime and resting is something you have to learn. Nippy's good at it. He's a good rester, but I'm like, you got to do stuff.
Oh yeah, I know.
Things to do.
I mean, when I first got out of the cult in that first year, and I was living in New York, and anyway, I was watching the Oscars for the first time, and you know, in 10 years, I maybe saw two movies, so I didn't even know what movies they were talking about. It was the year that the Mozart movie won, so I was watching the Oscars, and I just started crying and crying and crying. It's like, oh my God, I'm sitting here doing this, like, completely normal, mundane thing, you know, and it just felt so wonderful. And then I would watch football games, you know, and I would like make a big bowl of popcorn and watch football. And I was like, you know, I was a sort of a Giants fan because I was in New York, but I've always been a Packers fan because I'm from Wisconsin. But anyway, and I would sit and watch these games and eat my popcorn, but I would still feel guilty. You know, I would feel like I really, this is frivolous. I really should be doing something else. And it takes so much time to work through those old habits. I mean, that's what they are. And the things in our head that are still there, you know, telling us you're not being productive. You're not being productive.
I know you've also shared with me that it took you a while to be able to buy clothing and not feel too bourgeois.
Oh, I know. And first I bought a stereo set, and that was like, oh my God. I think I hid in my room for a week before I even set it up. And then I would buy clothes and I would put them in the closet with the label still on and not wear them. And, you know, like a year later, I'd go, oh yeah, I remember I bought that dress, you know. Because we didn't have things like that. We couldn't do that. You know, that was bourgeois. And so I still have a little bit of that. You know, it's interesting.
So what do you do with those? Like, if you could give a tip to people who are listening, like if you have that like thought, wait, is this me or is this like the cult indoctrination still in there? What do you do when you have that recognition?
Well, I think it's really important to, at least for me, and what's helped with a lot of the people I've worked with, is to write stuff down. There are some really good workbooks out now, like the Complex PTSD Workbook and the PTSD Workbook and things like that. But also you can just sort of make lists and make charts. And, you know, one of the things I did way in the beginning, because I was in a political cult and nobody was talking about political cults when I got out of my cult. So I made a list of like what made a religious cult, and then what were the things we did that paralleled that? And then I could look at that and go, oh yeah, we were a cult, you know, and our Jesus was Karl Marx, right? So when people have triggers or things that remain, I think really being aware of them so that when that thought happens or that, you know, that little critic inside your head is saying, don't do that, you need to just stop yourself. And sometimes by making lists, like these are the things that trigger me, or these are the thoughts that I have, and then look at them and say, well, where did this thought come from? Oh, it came from my training in the cult, you know? So you kind of disabuse the idea that these are really your own beliefs right now.
We tell our stories. We change the world. A Little Bit Culty is proud to support the hashtag I Got Out project, which empowers survivors of cultic abuse to share their stories online as a catalyst for education, prevention, and healing. Learn more about the hashtag I Got Out movement and find resources at igotout.org. I just was wondering, like, of the work that you did there, did you have to throw the baby out with the bathwater, or is there anything that you would take away as like part of who you still are, or what you still believe as like, or a way of operating or a value system or anything?
Yeah, I mean, that was a big deal. And I think, you know, I wrote this article years ago called Repairing the Soul After a Cult, because, you know, it's our deepest self that gets turned inside out and turned against us in our... And we give up our own values and our own code of morality to the cult, and we take on the cult leader's sense of values and moral code, if there is one. What I went through, because I was in a left-wing political cult, you know, I remember thinking, oh my God, am I now going to become like a right-wing maniac? You know, like, was all of this really awful? And now do I go to the other side? And so I did a lot of reading. I studied a lot of the communist dissidents, like in Yugoslavia and other countries, to get kind of a theoretical understanding. I went back and studied Marx and tried to understand better Marx's writings, and what were his writings before he joined up with the Communist Party, and what were his writings afterwards. And so, and I think people need to do the same thing if it's a religion or whatever. You need to unpack it. And I think that's why when people get out of cults, if they're smart, they don't right away rush into something else, because they first need to evaluate, what is it that I want? What is it that I believe in? So it did take time. It took time for me. I mean, it was years before I would even sign a petition, because right. that's what we would do all the time, is gather up names on petitions, right? Or go to right. a protest. The first protest I went to was the Women's March 2 years ago.
Mm. I mean, just took a couple decades.
Yeah, exactly. No, but you know, it's like you yeah. want to be sure that this is what you want, and not that someone else is pushing you to it.
No, you don't want to be a cult hopper.
Exactly. You don't want to be a cult hopper. And we do see plenty of that.
Yeah. There was actually one woman, I don't think I've even told you this, Nippy, who left just before the DOS stuff got active in, so she wasn't part of the, you know, the vow and the DOS and stuff. And she left and she started getting into yoga. And she, even after it all came crashing down, she started doing this yoga in LA and was about to make a lifetime commitment to this guru.
Spring has sprungeth, and you know what else is springing up? Hair. All across the land, people who have added Nutrafol to their hair health regimen are waking up to healthier, thicker manes. And that's a beautiful thing, because hair thinning is complicated. And the problem is, it's actually much bigger than your hair alone. Like your skin, hair is a reflection of your health, and internal factors can impact the way your hair looks, feels, and grows. Nutrafol's whole body approach multi-targets underlying root causes like stress, hormone fluctuations, and nutrient gaps for visibly thicker, stronger hair. And that's why we're thrilled to be on Team Nutrafol. Nutrafol is the number one dermatologist-recommended hair growth supplement, with over 1 million people saying thicker, stronger, faster-growing hair with less shedding. In a clinical study, 86% of women reported improved hair growth after taking Nutrafol's women's hair growth supplement for 6 months. 86. I like those numbers. Take the first step to visibly thicker, healthier hair. For a limited time, Nutrafol is offering our listeners $10 off your first month subscription and free shipping when you go to Nutrafol.com and enter the promo code CULTY. Find out why over 4,500 healthcare professionals and hairstylists recommend Nutrafol for healthier hair. Nutrafol.com, spelled Nutrafol.com, promo code CULTY. That's Nutrafol.com, promo code CULTY.
And everyone around her was like, you're doing it again. And she's like, no, but it's different. And then she's like, wait a second, maybe it's not.
I'll yeah. share my process, Yana, and maybe this is somewhat what you're talking about. When I got out, and I'd say Sarah and I's indoctrination was, we still had our lives outside of it, mm-hmm. right? And we still had things that we were pursuing outside of it. So our indoctrination wasn't entirely in, and there were still things that we just didn't agree with.
Because we never moved there.
And I wouldn't do
yeah.
it.
Yeah.
There were things I just wouldn't do. That was still me. And I would actually say, fuck that. I'm not doing it.
Nippy would say, what are you going to do? Cut my pay? Yeah.
No, that was my thing. He wasn't making money. Cut my pay. You need me. I don't need you. And like, I still had that kind of philosophy. And I decided when it came to my family was way more important than anything going on there. And I always said, if this thing were to go heads up or this thing were to end, there's 5 to 10 people that I would miss. Mm-hmm. And most of the Mexicans, I said it in the last podcast, they just brought great energy to everything they did, and they made it fun. And
a lot of great people from Mexico.
Aspect of it, and the people. All that said, you know, when I look at, I didn't consider myself political before the last election. I wasn't really interested in politics per se. I mean, I read a statistic where most people spend 4 minutes a week listening to politicians and are aware of it. Mm-hmm. But obviously that was something that was thrust in everyone's psychology, partly just because of the personality that was in charge. And I went down one side of it, down the other side of it, feeling, you know, outraged at Trump, and then seeing how one side handled the other side, just kind of the whole thing to me just felt really immature on both sides. And when I read the loaded language aspect of your book, it just felt like both sides were trying. And I say sides, you know, I think that's part of the problem is when you say sides, but both sides were really had loaded language. And, you know, at first blush, you think it's all Trump, but then you were in something that was considered far left. I'm sure you can identify a lot of the patterns going on in the media, like it's very hard to not be indoctrinated into something very, very quickly in today's media. And I'd love for you to comment on what you see, regardless of where you are politically, what you see going on with that dynamic now.
I think, you know, as we know, language is really powerful. And I think every, I don't know, what do we want to call them, special interest group has their way of communicating and kind of create their own language and handshakes and whatnot. And I think that when those things go mainstream, or get a television channel, or, you know, all kinds of internet, whatever, communities, the language can be very seductive and very persuasive. And certainly there's extremes on the left. In my opinion, the extremes on the right, at least in our country, are far more dangerous because they're armed and they're violent, whereas right. the left hasn't really ever been very good at that. That's why we never get anywhere. No, I don't want to say that, but
well, I mean, I've heard it put the right comes in, they kick your door open, and you know exactly what they look like, and the left is a little bit more covert. So it's overt aggression versus covert aggression, if that...
In the extremes of both sides, you mean?
In extremities, sorry, not...
Yeah, in the extremes, yeah. I suppose that's true. Although, you know, certainly in some cases, there has been violence on the left. I mean, you know, if we look nationally at Chairman Mao in China, you know, was certainly an example of that. And the sort of anarchists who muck up a lot of the very good demonstrations about social justice get taken over by these guys all in black who are, you know, mucking everything up and breaking the windows, and then the good guys get blamed. But anyway, yeah, so loading the language, which actually comes from Robert Lifton. I'm sure maybe you know that, or maybe you don't.
Yes.
But I don't know if all your listeners will, but Robert Lifton's book, Thought Reform and the Psychology of Totalism, which was very helpful to me because it was a study of the thought reform program in communist China, which was very much what I went through. So it was really the first thing I found that spoke to me. But he has these eight principles of a totalistic group, and loading the language is one of them. And all eight of them are spot on. And that's another thing that I often had people do when I worked with people, was take those eight characteristics of Lifton's and just list out, how did your cult do each one of those things? Those kinds of diagrams, I think, really help people, again, understand the enormity of what they were subjected to.
Do you think schools should have some sort of curriculum on this?
I absolutely do. I mean,
it's one of the things Sarah and I were thinking about.
I've talked about that we need a national education program. And of course, that sounds like socialism, so everybody freaks out when I say it. But
change the language. Right. Sticking with the theme, right?
I think that we, especially in America, I mean, you guys are in Canada, so you're a little better off. But you know, we've really seen the dumbing down of America. That's how I see it over the last decades. And, you know, certainly with the crazy talk radio and the all night talk radio and some of this stuff on TV and then all this stuff on the internet, I think people have lost their ability to really be discerning about what they're hearing and what they're looking at. And I saw this even as a college professor. I mean, I was on the scholarship committee for low-income kids, to give scholarships to low-income kids. And their resumes, these high school seniors, their resumes were so interesting because they were all told to focus on their service work, right? Like, oh, they worked at they went to a nursing home and read to the old people, or they scraped up doo-doo at the zoo or whatever. You know, it's like everything in high school they're being pushed at was about service. Mm. I think service is great, but what happened to critical thinking, right? And so there needs to be a re-emphasis on that. And I think if we can do that through the educational system and certainly start to really teach about this whole idea of unethical persuasion and healthy and unhealthy groups.
That's actually a great segue to one of my questions, which is in learning to understand what happened to me. I've obviously read your book and others, and there's a lot of words that are similar or terms that are similar, like, you know, brainwashing, indoctrination, mind control, different terms that kind of seem to undue influence mean similar things, but they're being batted around. And as the vernacular becomes more mainstream, like gaslighting was not a term that I was even familiar with when I joined NXIVM. What is the the main way that you like to describe what can happen to your brain in a cult, and what is that process?
Well, the way I see it is that a cult will have a belief system that, you know, promises you everything, that gives you a framework for understanding the past, the present, and the future, and offers you some kind of idealized goal, right? Whatever that might be. It could be religious, political, self-improvement, whatever, right? Within that belief system, there's a requirement that you have to go through a personal transformation in order to be on that path, to be accepted. That personal transformation is where the indoctrination program takes root. So I do call it an indoctrination program, but it's also what it is in sociological terms, is that it's a re-socialization. You are being re-socialized to be a good cult member. And we're socialized all throughout our life, right? As kids, we're socialized when we first go to school. We learn how to make friends and how to deal with bullies. And then we get a job and we're socialized into how are we supposed to behave at that job, right? So what happens is this intense re-socialization, part of it is attacking you, attacking yourself so that you doubt yourself and you think only this leader or the people who are training you have the answers. And as they tear apart you, they're kind of building and reinforcing this new you until you get to the point where, in extreme cases, you kind of don't even remember who you originally were. And it's why people say, oh, I saw my son or my daughter or my whoever, and they just seemed like a completely different person, right? Because in many aspects, you are. You're single-minded. You only talk about certain things. You're defensive. You're whatever, right? So that resocialization obviously changes your patterns of thought and changes your behaviors. So we can call it brainwashing. I originally had no problem with that, but what's happened over time is that the word has gotten so misused and misunderstood, and there are cult apologists who try to keep us from using that word. So I kind of stay away from it just to not get lost in that muck, because I'd rather be able to do what I do. And so I see that through the indoctrination, you get to this point where you're enclosed in this kind of altered reality. And you enter what I call bounded choice, this place where your choices are constrained and confined by the desires of the group and the leader.
Right.
So yes, there's brainwashing. I was one of the main brainwashers in the group I was in. I actually, one of my assignments at one point was to create a brainwashing program, literally. We called it party school, and the top members had to attend it. And we told them that they were willingly being brainwashed. And we did. We willingly brainwashed ourselves because we wanted to be those good communists, right? So other terms like mind control, I don't like at all, because I feel like it's too mechanical.
It has a clinical kind of...
Well, to me, it has more of a mystical. It's like, you know, you're some zombie and some person back there is telling you what to do. That's not really how it works. You're telling you what to do because you've internalized all the beliefs and the rules and the requirements of the system. You're checking yourself, right? You're stopping yourself from doing things. You're keeping yourself in the group because that's what you've been re-socialized to do.
Like gaslighting yourself.
Yeah, in a sense, yeah. I'm not saying that, yes, you're doing this, that nobody duped you. Yeah, you were duped in the sense that this isn't what you thought you were getting into. You know, if somebody told me, oh, come join this group and you're going to be a heartless, cold bitch. I mean, I wouldn't have signed up for that. Right.
Right. So much of every conversation I have with this work is like, OK, let's say one of the loyal, we call them the loyalists, the true believers. Let's say they're listening. And I know their belief system and their outlook on us, because I used to be them.
Right.
You know, I used to have that belief system. And I know that everything that we do is proof that the world is out to get them. Because, of course, there's no victims except for them. There's no victims in the world except for Keith, who's a victim now to the judicial system.
Right.
And me, Mark, Bonnie, and Catherine, and the rest of us. But anyway, I'm always seeing things through the lens of like how to reach them. And I know that if they were to hear that, they would say, as I would have said, I'm not a new me. I'm a better me. I'm a better me. I'm more this, this, and this. And I'm not brainwashed because I'm choosing this and I'm at cause. And look how happy and successful I am. And you just don't get it. So like, how do you ever get through to that self-sealed system, to use your words, or closed loop logic is another term I've heard. Like, how do you get through to that? Or is it just that they have to have their own wake up moment themselves?
Ultimately, they have to have their own wake up moment. I think that's how most people leave groups. I do think that everybody has doubts and moments of like, I'm not so sure. And, you know, the way I've described it is that we have this little shelf in the back of our head and we put all the doubts there because we can't express them, obviously. And then at some point, you know, one more thing happens and that shelf breaks and then the doubts come spilling out. Then you have to kind of figure out, okay, I see something is wrong here. How do I leave? How do I get myself out?
I love that metaphor.
So I think what those of us who have people on the inside of whatever group or rabbit hole, what I always say is you need to plant seeds on that shelf. That'll grow. That'll eventually cause the shelf to be too heavy and break. So that it's you can't directly confront, but you have to sort of plant ideas that'll kind of moil around in their head and get them to see, start to see things in a different way. And you may never know when that's going to work or how that's going to work. I guess you should also never give up hope.
I don't. And we actually, Nippy and I have debates about who's going to leave or not leave. And we think that some people may never, but I always hold out hope that I will welcome back any of them,
right?
Even ones that have been total assholes to me and shit talked me to no end. I get it. They, you know, I will hug them as long as there's no coronavirus. I will hug them. I will accept their apology. Right. We can just water under the bridge, you know, and I feel that way pretty much towards everybody. But I think,
except
you know,
Keith.
I would, you know, yeah, no, he can rot in prison. Absolutely. But I think that like, I can't plant those seeds because they still hate me, and that's fine. And that's fair, but not many people know this, but almost everyone that's still loyal, respective family members have reached out to us and want to help their children. And, you know, we've tried to help them plant the seeds.
Right.
And that's sort of the only thing that we can do, because anything coming from us is seen as,
They dig their heels in even more.
Yeah,
right. Exactly. But, you know, I'll tell you a story of one of the few interventions I ever did. This was years ago, but I was working with a family whose daughter had joined a political cult. She had been a student at Berkeley and dropped out of school to be in this group. And they had another daughter who committed suicide. And they were from Hawaii, and they were going to have the funeral in Hawaii. And the cult had agreed that the girl could go attend the funeral. So they said to us, the intervention team, they wanted us to do the intervention then. And we said, no, this is like a bad time. No, just, you know. And they said, this is the only way we can make sense of our other daughter's death, is to use this opportunity to meet with our other daughter. So we all went to Hawaii. The funeral happened the day or two later. She came over to her aunt's house and we were there. They introduced us. We had, I would say, maximum a half an hour with her of, you know, asking her some questions, saying a few things, trying to get her to talk a little bit. And after a half an hour, she jumped up, ran out of the house, ran down the hill to a phone booth and called the police. First, she called her cult and they bought her a ticket. She called the police. She stayed in the phone booth. She told the police she was being held against her will, which of course she wasn't. And they took her to the airport and she flew back to California. So, you know, we felt terrible, of course. 6 months later, she left the group. Because some of the few things we said to her stayed with her. And when she got back to the group, she started to see things differently. And finally, one day she said, I'm out of here. And she left. And so, you know, you never know what's going to make a difference. But one thing I want to mention is that my colleague Colleen Russell and I are starting support groups for families.
Oh, that's
families
so great.
And friends who have someone in a cult. So if
Fantastic.
You know anyone who'd be interested in that.
We have like eight families off the top of my head.
Yeah. And we're going to do them on Zoom like we do the support group for former members. Mm. It'll be every other week. I think right now we're thinking Friday afternoons because we're thinking a lot of people might not be working anyway because of the pandemic. So we're going to start those next month.
speaking of true believers, I know that somebody reached out to you and asked you to
evaluate
Keith, and that it was unfair the way he was being evaluated without having ever met him or had any discourse with him. And I'm just wondering if you could share why you don't think you need to do that to assess him.
Well, I mean, would I need to assess Jeffrey Dahmer to see if he really did eat people after he murdered them? I mean, there's so much evidence of who Keith was, not only all of the information that I've gained from all of the former NXIVM people that I've talked to, but even if some people are going to say, well, that's just a false narrative that's made up, so much very concrete evidence came out in the trial of Keith saying things in his own words, videos, photographs, trainings, him leading trainings. This wasn't other people saying it about him. It was him saying these things. And looking back at his history of running scams, that I think it wouldn't really be of any benefit to my understanding of him to read whatever documents that person offered me or a conversation with him. Mm-hmm. Which I can't even imagine how that would happen. So, I mean, yes, there are times when I would love to interview some cult leader or another, but not because, at least in this case, I think I'm wrong about my impressions of Keith Raniere.
Right. So their belief on you is that you can't see what a noble, kind, humanitarian, ethical man he is. And it's just your lack of true depth and willingness to see the truth about him. But really what it is, I think, is that you see an underlying assumption, which is that he's not a good person, that he is a sociopathic, narcissistic, sex addicted, megalomaniac. They
sadist,
see him.
You forgot sadist.
Oh, sadist. Yes. Sadist. Yes. All those things. And they see him as good intentioned, doing unconventional things to try to help people, specifically in this case with DOS, women, to find their true strength and to uphold each other and be more accountable, blah, 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 all that word salad bullshit. But the assumption underneath it is that they still think he's good.
But how can he be good when he's starving women?
Oh, I know.
People are malnourished. I mean, the chiropractor at the trial said, you know, he thought these women were malnourished. I mean, this isn't just some made up thing. I mean, he's starving people. He's planning to build a kind of torture chamber in the basement of one of the houses. I mean,
he's a total hypocrite.
Yeah, he's a hypocrite, and he's cruel, and he's, you know, I mean, how is that a divine being?
No, absolutely. I mean, you don't have to convince me of that.
I think just having people read the 15 characteristics of a sociopath, if that doesn't change their mind about him, then they don't. There's a great, I think it was Edward Snowden said it in a podcast.
You have three quotes this podcast.
Yeah, no,
I'm busting out the quotes. Do it.
Well, you can't wake people up that are pretending to be asleep.
Yeah.
And that actually leads me to possibly my final question and something I'm going to ask of you to participate in, which is that we have a segment in our show called "That Really Chaps My Ass."
That must be a Canadian expression.
Oh, you don't have that? Chaps my ass? Nippy says
Yanya,
it all the time.
I'm American. I'm from Atlanta, Georgia.
Oh,
I'm not Canadian.
Yeah. So what chaps my ass is like something that really pisses you off, and specifically about your cult. So I'm asking this to cult survivors like yourself. So I'll give you an example and then you can think of something. So every now and then Nippy and I turn to each other and we go, you know what really chaps my ass? And in this case, speaking of Keith being a hypocrite, there was so much dogma about keeping your word and being on time. In fact, if we were not on time, especially in the SOP trainings, you probably know this. If somebody was 10 minutes late, we stood for 10 minutes after that person arrived in silence so that person could feel the weight of their lateness and how that affected the whole group and shit like that, right? Then at every V week at night, there'd be like some sort of event or performance at around 7 or 7:30 or even later sometimes. But it'd be a set time.
I wouldn't go.
And we always waited for at least an hour for Keith. He would always be the last person to come strolling in and sit down. And we always thought that he was doing important stuff. And we found out later he was fucking women. He was late because he was having threesomes and like whatever kind of like, you know, sex in itself isn't a problem. But his...
since he can't get it up, but...
Yeah. Well, no wonder he was late. It took a while. So that really chaps my fucking ass that we waited for so long for him and he was just going out and, you know, being douchey. So anyway, do you have a, that really chaps your ass? Maybe something you haven't shared about something that happened in your cult that you're like, ugh, can't believe that happened.
Well, I mean, one of the things I can think of that used to really, I don't know if it was piss me off, but freak me out was those of us in the inner circle would have these sessions with our leader, usually at her house in Bodega Bay, like a bunch of us would have to go up there for weekends or holidays or whatever. And she drank hard alcohol and we would have to drink along with her. And, you know, most of us are sitting on the floor and she's ranting and talking about her childhood and this nonsense. And then she would want us to sing The House of the Rising Sun, because that was her favorite song. And each of us had to then make up a verse to go with the song. So if it got to your turn and you couldn't think of a verse or she didn't like the verse you made up, then she would like slap you across the face. And
wow.
So that, I don't know if that chapped my ass, but it was one of the reasons I used to then make up excuses to not go to those anymore. I would pretend I was sick because I was like, I can't take part in that bullshit anymore. And on top of it, one time her dog bit me in the ass and that really chapped my ass. I am a pure dog lover and no dog has ever bitten me except her Rottweiler guard dog. So that was another beef.
I think those are two really good qualify? Examples. Yes. Yes.
Quite literally. Yes.
Absolutely. That's a great note to end on. But there was one person who asked if you could answer this briefly, if there's any steps that you can recommend for people to become an expert or a deprogrammer, because I think also the world needs it right now. There's not enough. So is there like a path or a program that people can take or anything like that?
This is a cult survivor asking this question.
Mm-hmm.
Well, first of all, I feel very strongly people should not become activists too soon. I think they need to, yes, Sarah, they need to deal with their healing and their self-care first, which I think you did that year with the baby. So I forgive you.
Thank you.
But in general, I think becoming an activist too soon isn't terrific and can set you back. But then, I think sharing your story, talking about the things that, you know, that bothered you when you were in your group and maybe helped you decide to leave one day. I think sharing stories is really important. I think depending on what cult you were in, many cults have started websites of information about that group and survivor networks. So doing things like that. And then, you know, perhaps working with families who have someone in the same cult you were in, I think is where you can be the most helpful.
Okay.
So I think it's just, you know, putting yourself out there, but also make sure you do your homework and understand the whole phenomena so that you don't mm-hmm. muck up somewhere along the road.
And is there a way to actually become an official deprogrammer or exit counselor?
No. I mean, first okay. of all, deprogramming is
no, that's not a term people use.
It's
anymore,
an archaic
right?
word. Yeah. And even the exit, most of the exit counselors today have become more like, family mediation folks. I think interventions are happening less and less, and it's really about trying to help the family or friends find ways to communicate and stay in touch with the person and be that safe haven that they can come to if they decide to leave.
Well, it seems like that's sort of been part of our journey. And you're right. I did become a fighter before I'd healed, although it was kind of healing for me to be the fighter, but I did have that recognition. I don't know if I've told you when I finished your book that I realized that because I've been fighting, even when I was building Nexium, I was, you know, fighting the world. And then now I was fighting the cult. And so now that the fight is over, it's like, now I get to figure out who I am.
Mm-hmm.
And that was really emotional to get to the end of your book and realize that I still have work to do.
Yeah. I mean, I believe it takes about 5 years after you get out of a cult, again, depending on how long you were in and at what level and all of that. But I think
right.
5 years is kind of an average of when you finally know who you are.
Mm. I look forward to that.
Yeah.
You wrote in the book When I Met You, which was, by the way, on April 11th, 2018. Wow. And you said, "Dear brave, wonderful, lovely Sarah," that's very sweet, thank you, "despite your savior complex, you're doing well and will only do better in taking back your life." Savior complex, do you think that's like, I feel like in my own healing journey, that's what drove me in it and is also what drove me outside of it. Where do you think that comes from? And what's the best way to put that to bed, put that to rest?
Well, I think it comes from, at least for most of us, the groups that we were in were about having the answer, right? We had mm-hmm. the answer and we were going to change the world. Maybe not always that grandiose, but it's about being right, having the right ideas and the right behaviors, right? So when we get out, I think there's still that tendency to want to be right, but now it's in the opposite way, and to have the right behaviors, which now means, you know, trying to get everybody else out of that group or help other people who are in groups, because, you know, what gets people into cults is idealism. You know, it's not weakness, it's not psychological problems, it's idealism. That idealism was betrayed and it was used against you. So now you're out, that little idealistic component is still there, only now you want to kind of reverse it back, and you have to wait. You have to deal with self-care first.
Okay. And that's a really good advice. What's the number one self-care thing that people should do when they leave cults, do you think?
Sleep.
Yes. I also thought that buying flowers for your wife was a really big part of self-care. Oh, no, wait. Sorry. That's just kidding.
Or Air Force One gold.
Yes. At the beginning of the show, we talked about how Nippy bought me the best present ever, which was gold running shoes, which are so bourgeois. They're so bourgeois. Yeah. No, you'd freak out if you saw these shoes.
They're not real gold. They're gold colored.
They're not gold plated.
They're gold plated.
No, they're come on. Knock it off.
Okay, well, just to wrap up, is there anything else that you want people to know, like in terms of your desire to spread truth about these issues, like that you feel like is an important nugget to take away?
No, I just think in general, people need to slow down if they're thinking about joining something and do their research and be good consumers. And there's a lot of information out there. The internet's being used to recruit people, but there's also good information there that can be used to help educate you so that mm-hmm. somebody doesn't jump into the wrong rabbit hole.
Okay. And if they do, and they need help getting out, they can read your book.
They can read my book. They can go to my website, cultresearch.org.
And they can reach out to you if they want to get some support with their family or join one of your groups.
Yes, absolutely.
What are the other things that you want people to know about what you're doing right now, where to find you?
Well, they can find me through my website. There's a way to email me. They should also know that I have the book about children who grew up in cults, which is actually the big population coming out of groups right now. So that book is called Escaping Utopia.
And okay, I should probably read that.
I interviewed 65 people who grew up in a cult, because people who grew up in a cult, when they come out, they have slightly different issues. So that's also another resource. And what else am I doing? I wrote my memoir and I'm trying to get it published. And
I can't wait to read that.
I walk my dog and I can't wait for the pandemic to be over because I'm anxious to travel again. And maybe I'll even come to Vancouver.
Well, we would love to host you and spend more time with you because we both just think the world of you. And
well, thank you.
So grateful you've provided a resource for, I'm going to cry.
No, don't cry.
You're going to cry. Provided a resource for our healing. Like, it's just been really profound for us. So thank you for taking the time to share your wisdom and your humor and your Yanya essence.
Thank you. Thanks, Sarah and Nippy.
Thank you, Yanya.
Yeah.
You're the best.
Thank you.
Until next time.
Wow, she's great.
Isn't she amazing?
Sarah. Oh, yeah. Oh, I know. I know. What'd you like?
Well, I like the term resocialization because I think that people can wrap their head around that better than mind control or brainwashing because it's just so obscure and something out of a sci-fi movie, which also does happen. But I think that my biggest takeaway from talking to Yanya and also from narrating her book was that, you know, you really have to take time to heal after getting out of something like this. And most people don't. they think just waking up and realizing that they were conned or that they were in a cult or a culty group is enough. It's not. You have to understand the systems of influence and what happened to you and your brain and your life and your value system and everything. Otherwise, you will do it again and you will not heal.
Or you're just not making really sound decisions.
No.
Your framework's been toyed with.
And I think also the book's really good at breaking down the different types of cults, because people may have a certain stigma around things like, you know, religious cults. And, you know, the whole point of this podcast is looking at things from like what's a little bit culty to a lot culty. And some of these organizations and groups, whether it be a religious cult, a family cult, a spiritual cult, a new age cult, I also recognized, you know, obviously ours fall under what's called a large group awareness training, personal development programs. But when Keith created DOS, he was bringing into and using methods like in terms of branding from a cult, like satanic cults. And that freaked me out because, I mean, I knew he'd gotten dark, but I hadn't made that correlation until I read the book.
Right.
So just understanding, you know, what methods were done to your mind and to your value system and everything, and where did it come from? Just getting that education is a huge part of the
education.
Healing.
That's the thing I was going to go in on. I think this is all valuable education, regardless of whatever word you want to use, socialized, indoctrinated, or anything like that. There needs to be some sort of awareness just into how all these things work. Whether it be, you know, when you go to school, you're being indoctrinated. When you go to church, you're being indoctrinated.
That's a healthy authority.
I think I like about that is there ought to be something in our schools that explains it, which is, you know, exciting. I think her book, you know, for me, it was the first thing I literally read. I'd watched a couple of their videos, but when I read hers, it read quickly. And even just the first 30 to 40 pages were, regardless of whether or not you've been in something like this, is valuable just in terms of self-awareness.
You know, so, she also wrote the script to a TED Talk that's online, and we'll share that video in our notes. It's called Why Do People Join Cults? And it's just a couple minutes, breaks it down super clear. And that is also a great resource for something that might just be full cult or something that's a little bit culty.
So wrapping up, thanks everyone for listening. We'll post more information on Yanya's work and works in our show notes. And her book is Take Back Your Life. It's available everywhere you can get your books.
And also the audio version coming in the next couple of months. Thanks guys for listening. I hope you found this as interesting as we did. Till next time. Seeking down to the depths of the ocean. We're going to be back soon with more episodes of A Little Bit Culty with more experts and survivors and sometimes experts who are survivors and some familiar faces from The Vow.
If you got suggestions or questions on upcoming topics, find us on Instagram at A Little Bit Culty.
And for more background on what got me to this point, my memoir, Scarred, the true story of how I escaped Nexium, the cult that bound my life, is available on Amazon, Audible, and wherever books are sold.
If you'd like to help us spread the word about A Little Bit Culty podcast, please give us a 5-star review and tell your friends to subscribe.
Like literally take their phone out and press subscribe.
5 stars. That's 5 of them.
We're available on Apple Podcasts, Spotify, and every major listening app. A Little Bit Culty is executive produced by me, your co-host, Sarah Edmondson, and Anthony Nippy Ames. Associate producer is Jess Tardy. Produced, edited, mixed, and mastered by Citizens of Sound. Our amazing theme song, Cultivated, is by John Bryant and co-written by Nigel Asselin. Additional original music is composed by Will Rutherford.
We'll be back with more episodes. Until then,
don't join a cult. I'm Sarah Edmondson, and thanks for listening to A Little Bit Culty.